The following Dharma talk was recorded in May 2015 in St. Louis, Missouri, from the retreat called Anatta, the Buddha's Teaching on Non-Self, taught by Gloria Tirania Ambrosia. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Gloria Tirania Ambrosia teaches within the Thai forest tradition and is a lay Buddhist minister in association with Abhayagiri Buddhist Monastery in California. She has been a Dhamma teacher since 1990, served as a resident teacher of the Insight Meditation Society from 1996 to 1999, and is a core faculty member at Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, where she does most of her teaching. For more information, go to www.bcbsdharma.org.
So I have a little bit more. What I want to do tonight is kind of pull some things together that I've already talked about, but put them all together in the under the heading of non-attachment and non-self. And then a little bit more tomorrow morning, and hopefully we've done some justice to the topic and that you can leave here with some sense of knowing what it is that we're even talking about and how to work with it. So one of the things that we see right away when we meditate is the unbelievable extent of the mind's preoccupation, not only with itself, but with what's going on in the body. And we see it not only the first time that we sit down and meditate. You know, if it's not here, where is it? You know, and you might pose that question to yourself sometimes, like, where is it? Why am I not able to just be here and settle? And the reason it isn't is because it's caught up with sensations. It's caught up with feelings. It's caught up with thoughts, mental states, as well as the conditions of our lives and the reactions. All of those will come up in relation to the conditions of our lives. So you see it right there. And the mind isn't quiet for us as meditators. You know, if it's not, where is it? That's where it's caught up. It's preoccupied. So the Buddha says that this tendency, this habit of the unawakened mind, constitutes a tremendous amount of energy, pulls on a tremendous amount of energy in the system, and it constitutes much, if not all, of our suffering. It's also what constitutes the formation, the formulation of self-view. These are one and the same thing in many respects. So when we're preoccupied with the body and mind in this way, what you begin to notice, just even if you're standing back just a little bit, is that all the attention is there. And in itself, that's painful. But then what it does also is it starts to trigger even more reactive patterns down the road, and which have the effect of compounding the difficulty that we're already feeling. So the whole system just starts to feel like it's playing out a lot of compulsive and neurotic modes, doesn't it? I mean, it's just on automatic pilot. You can be gone for a long time, can't you? You know, before you come to. And if you could retrace where it has been, it's been just following a chain of attachment from one thing to another to another. It's possible, I often quote one of my teachers, Ajahn Sucitto. He says, you could live your whole life in a completely neurotic and compulsive mode. And some people do, that literally, because there's not any, they haven't cultivated the habit or the understanding to stand outside of it and to look and see what in the heck is going on here. So if we're completely preoccupied, identified with the body and mind, then these modes are our modus operandi. It's a pretty frightening thought, isn't it? You know, when you consider it. And I would say, sad to say, I think that's true. You know, I've certainly seen it in myself, but you also see people who are just completely clueless. You know, no idea. And it's sad. It's not to be critical. It's just to acknowledge that that's what's going on and to feel the pain of that. So that's the forecast, you know, until or unless we begin to turn it around and look at things a little differently. And if that's our standard operating procedure, then it's likely to spend our whole life just completely tangled. And this being tangled in this way is one of the ways that the Buddha characterizes ignorance. You know, it's just not seeing things clearly. But fortunately, we all have the very good karma of being drawn to these teachings. And there's just so much here. And, you know, what I want to do is just pull together some of the gifts that he's given us and recognize and make sure that we understand and see what it is that we're drawn to and what the tools are that he's given us and how we're using them. It's not how to use them because we're already using them. So, you know, the first we have the four foundations of mindfulness, and the Buddha is encouraging us through this to cultivate a kind of non-attachment, a way of looking at that experience, that unbelievable preoccupation with an increasingly non-attached, impartial, objective perspective. And we have the hardware to be able to do this. This mind can do that. It can look at itself. It can look at the body and with some semblance of impartiality. So this is our primary tool. And not only for breaking up the useless habits, because, you know, you shine a spotlight on this stuff, and sometimes it has the effect, and I bet you've seen this sometimes, of just making things go poof, you know. So you begin to look right at them, but also, for seeing how they're happening. And that's the critical bit. Just beginning to realize through this teaching and others like dependent origination, how this progression of papancha and preoccupation is taking place. You know, and that needs to be seen. Often it's seen in hindsight after you snap out of it and you retrace your steps, but that's good enough. You know, that's actually very good. So, you know, begin to see how it happens, which in itself is insight. But then, once we can settle down enough out of the content of it all, and look with a high degree of objectivity, now this amazing shift takes place in the capacity of the observing to stop being so caught up in the content and begin to go, now, how is this happening? And look at the processes of the mind. And that now you're really cooking on all cylinders, you know, to be able to see, to get that objective that you're looking at the processes of the mind and not so caught up in the content. So practice as it's outlined in the foundations of mindfulness is how we do that. And it's an invitation, if you will, to look at sensations, feelings, and thoughts. And in a way, I like to phrase it this way, leave it at that. You know, the way the Buddha says it, see the body as the body, see the feelings as feelings, see the mind as the mind, right? That's it. That connotes to me some sense of just see it. And admittedly, it takes a lot of faith. But we get faith in it as we do it because there's something to that, way of relating that just lets it be that, you know, it affects more of the same. It actually brings us, increases the non-attachment and the objectivity. And again, it sets us up for insight. So, and it's interesting to me, and this is just a realization I've had through the years, that, you know, one doesn't really have to know, that this practice is about non-attachment. You know, sometimes you hear that idea of non-attachment. It may not sound very attractive. One doesn't particularly want to go there. But it's significant that you don't even have to know that that's what it's about. In fact, if you do know that it's about and you think you need to be non-attached, and then you try to force compliance with that or try to make yourself, I know what I need. I need non-attachment, you know. Well, that in itself is a very attached perspective, you know. and so, you know, if you try to force it, then it sets up a way of being with it all that is, you know, counterproductive. The very effort of that is an attachment in itself. So you don't really have to understand that it's about non-attachment, and you don't really even have to know what non-attachment is. initially. In a way, you just have to do what the Buddha is saying. You just have to follow the directions and try to discover for ourselves what it means to relate to this experience of the body and feelings and mind, which seems so personal. And try to relate to it from a perspective that is decidedly impersonal. You know, just to begin to move in that direction and be with the body and mind, body, feelings, and mind in this way. And I think that's a very interesting point to contemplate in and of itself. You know, as practitioners, and I've been amazed by this, certainly in myself, because I can be very willful, you know, we tend to be very compliant. And I think the reason why I think it's important to contemplate is that something is drawing us to this practice. And for a long time, we may not know what we're doing. I mean, a long time, you know, I don't know about you, but I 8 years, 10 years down the road, I'd sit sometimes in meditation and go, what am I doing? You know, what am I trying to do here? You know, and you don't know what you're doing. But you do it anyway. Isn't that wild? You know, there's a lot of faith driving us in this practice, and it goes on for a really long time. We don't know what we're doing, or in a way, we may not even know why we're doing it, but we do it anyway. And I can remember having feelings for a long time. I remember sitting one time and just kind of feeling like hoping against hope. That the Buddha was right, you know, and that he knew what he was doing, and that this practice that he told me to do, and that I've now spent years at, you know, literally, I mean, I stopped everything and sat on the cushion for a couple of years, you know, literally, you know, just doing it day after day after day after day after day, and just having that feeling that, well, I hope he's right. And that this is all leading someplace, because I didn't know. I don't know. You know, it's a lot of faith in that. And, it wasn't until I turned around and looked at that, because if you rest in that, I don't know, it feels like confusion and I don't know what I'm doing and all like that. But if you look instead at the fact that you don't know, but you're still doing it. That is an indicator of a tremendous faith and even confidence somehow. It sounds really right, and I've tried everything else, that kind of thing. And so let me give this my all, you know. And I just imagined that it would somehow bear fruit, and over time we see that it has, you know. We've at least enjoyed a few moments of peace, haven't we, through doing this practice. And so when we talk about beginner's mind, too, I think this is an important thing to contemplate. I didn't really grasp how significant that was. You know, there's different interpretations of beginner's mind, but I'm talking about it as the bit that doesn't, that's willing to not know. You know, and stay with it as long as it takes to establish oneself in some kind of understanding. So it took me very many years to arrive at that place where I felt like, you know, I think I'm starting to understand what this is all about, you know. And I share that with you, not to be self-effacing, but just to acknowledge if you're having those kinds of feelings. This is, you know, very normal. I think it's a very normal part of the process, you know, and it's a very helpful and supportive, aspect, of our, of the way that we're looking at it, the way that we're relating to it, just to see and to acknowledge that in spite of that, you're still staying with it, you know, in spite of not really understanding yet. And so also for a long time, what happens is we just keep catching ourselves in the act of having been caught up and then letting go, and having been caught up and letting go, having been caught up and letting go, having been caught up and letting go, having been caught up and letting go. It goes like that, doesn't it? And this really constitutes the bulk of the practice. Now, if you think you shouldn't be getting caught up, and if somehow you should be further than you are, or not getting tangled in this way, then you know, you're going to suffer a lot in practice, and we do for many years because of that. That kind of thing, you know. It's compounding it, because this is going to go on for a gazillion times. This is going to, we're going to keep finding ourselves in this state. And we have to know. I think it's very helpful just to talk about this. Let's be honest. I mean, can we talk? You know, this is what it's like. If we understand that if this is how it's going for you, if this is how your practice is going, it's going great. It's going great. And this is the process of wearing down the old patterns and the delusion and learning to relate skillfully. This is actually how it happens. And this is very good. This is what we're all going through. And then, you know, I've indicated a couple of times this weekend that wonderful things are being cultivated in that. And there were two of the paramis in particular, certainly a lot of them, but patience, Kanti, and aditana, determination. Boy, do we have determination. You know, just notice, I'm getting goosebumps. I mean, do you notice it? Do you feel it? Do you see how determined you are? As hard as it has been, and as some of us have been at this for a long time, you know? So you have these wonderful side effects, these kind of fringe benefits that kind of come in the back door, in many ways are the fruits of practice, but also the things that you're going to see most immediately and how it is that we're relating to each other. You know, because if we can develop that kind of patience with ourselves, we're going to have greater and greater patience with each other. So I find that, as I've said over the weekend, I find that one of the biggest hurdles in practice is just learning how to hold that moment when we wake up, when we come to, because just to look at what's going on there, getting caught up and lost in self-view, getting caught up in the preoccupation with the body and mind, it's like falling asleep. You know, it is falling asleep. That's why they call it waking up, you know, when you snap out of it. You know, and if you've ever tried to see the moment when you fall asleep, which I've done, it's ridiculous, but I did try it. And, you discover that you don't see it. You never see yourself fall asleep. You know, so that's an interesting reflection right there, because if this is akin to that or is a manifestation of that, then it doesn't make any sense to beat up on ourselves when we come to, you know. You can't see it. You didn't see it. You can't see it. What's the sense of smacking ourselves around when we come to because we didn't see it happen? It's like, hello, you know, you don't see it happen. And so most of the time, if not all the time, we're actually seeing it in hindsight when we recover. And so I say it's one of the biggest hurdles because right there is that moment of recognizing that we've been out to lunch is just one of those moments that the sense of self loves to grab. You know, and so the habit of self-view, if that gets filtered through self-view, which it does for many years, then that moment is going to be one wherein we turn it back on ourselves. And very likely, either you just get irritated with yourself or, you know, literally start berating ourselves for having been caught up like that. What's wrong with me? Why can't I do this practice? Why can't I see what's going on and stay with it and not drift off like this all of the time? But as I said, if you understand that that's the way it is, then that the possibility of getting caught in that kind of thinking can be dramatically diminished. And it needs to be, because that catching it, holding it through the sense of self is only going to compound it. It's only going to keep you there longer. But we have to see this, and this goes on for many, many years. It just takes some time to learn how to objectively observe what's happening and to untangle all of this. And, you know, little by little, we just kind of hold it with a more loving and compassionate heart so that tendency to turn it back on ourselves diminishes over time. So the habit of self-view is what you're seeing, both in the grabbing and in the reacting to what we do, how we, when we catch ourselves having grabbed. Both of those. That's where you're going to see the sense of self being formed. It's very persnickety. And if it doesn't get challenged, you know, it's not going to get challenged as long as we fail to see it as such. And so, you know, hopefully just talking about it and understanding what the Buddha is pointing to here can be a huge help to us to say, oh, that's it. That's it. That's it. Can you feel that? It's not, it's, oh, that's it. That's very different, you know, very different response or reaction. But because you have to know that it's going to keep happening for a while. And even after we see it, it keeps happening. Even after we see it and understanding, it keeps happening. And that is pointing to how strong that habit of ignorance is. It's very deeply entrenched. So I find it just helpful to see that also that the feeling of being irritated when we snap out of it. Just look at that. That's actually the feeling or the voice of the pain that we're in having been caught. That's all it is. You know, you can, and it's personalizing it, but it's just that hurt. Ah, that hurt, you know, to be out to lunch like that. And then if you see it in that way, it can really stir the compassion in the heart rather than the irritation. And that's what we need. So we have to understand that as long as self-view dominates, then we're going to be likely to react with irritation when we see ourselves caught in it and when we can't seem to fix it. Self-view is the bit that thinks it's the fixer. It comes in and it thinks I messed up and I have to fix it. It's sort of the language of it. But it's not the fixer. It's actually the reason why we're there in the first place. It's the complicator. It's the tangler. It's the judger. It's the criticizer. It's all of that. And so it actually is how it is that we even got where we are. So gradually we start to see through it and we slowly begin to lose the reactivity. And if you're like me, there's a subtle aspect to it I can only characterize it as just getting sick of it. You know, you just, bleh, I'm so sick of this. And you have this feeling of kind of throwing in the towel. And you can feel very defeated. And if that's how it's going, man, it's going really good. Because what's getting defeated is this habit of the mind. And we want that to be defeated. We want that to die. We want that to give up, throw in the towel, if you will. And then after, as this sense of self diminishes in the system, then, increasingly over the years of practice, and I'll bet many of you can attest to this, it becomes more the case that you see yourself caught up, you release. You see yourself caught up, you release. You see yourself caught up, you release. But without all the kerfuffle, you know, there's no comment about it. There's no going on about it in the mind. It's almost like a force field starts to develop around the reactivity to the conditions that we find ourselves in. Have you ever felt that? It's wild. Like you start to go, you can almost feel the mind start to whine and it can't get up a full head of steam, you know? It's like, and it can actually feel a little bit, I don't know, I sort of missed it a little bit. You know what I mean? It's kind of like there's a hole where it used to be, and it's like, it's not that I never get into it. That's not what I'm saying. But that just the, certainly when you start, it's a familiar. It's a way that you've always been, and it's not there anymore, or it's weakening enough to be significant, to be noticeable. You know, and this is all a sign that you're maturing in practice. You're maturing in non-attachment. You're maturing in the release of self-view. And it's great. It's really delicious. So, and really, this is actually how self-view is overcome as well. You know, people tend to want a lightning bolt, you know. Mm-hmm. And I know I did. I thought I was just going to sit in meditation for a couple of months and get some kind of big zinger, you know, and then, you know, wear white for the rest of my life and walk a few feet above the floor, you know, somehow. And it's just going to be exalted into some heavenly state, you know. And I think that's pretty common. I mean, maybe a little too flowery for me. I tend to be dramatic, but I certainly had those kinds of notions. And you can feel yourself, like you hear things like non-self, you know, and I want non-self, I want non-self, I want non-self, you know. I want to have a no-self experience. People would talk about that in interviews when I was practicing, you know. Did you have a no-self experience? You know, that kind of thing. It's like a commodity. You know, yeah, you want it. You want to know what you have to do to get it. You know, that kind of thing. And so people tend to expect that, but you know, you discover over the years of practice, don't you? That it's not like that. You know, and there may not even be any kind of direct aha moment where you get it. You know. And this one gal that I talked to, she's always saying that, I got it, I got it. You know, well, you can know if you're saying that you didn't get it, you know. it's not like that, you know. And so relinquishing self-view, it may not even be fully conscious. In fact, it's quite possible and common that you don't know it for some time. It's quite subtle. The way to characterize it is just that one just tends to drift slowly away from getting caught up in everything that's arising. You know, just stop the preoccupation. Stop getting caught up in everything that's happening and going on about it, creating a lot of papancha. Or in getting annoyed with ourselves if we see that we have done that. You know, that diminishes over time, doesn't it? So, you know, even in those moments when you feel like you're still very tangled, you know, you have to know that because you're meditating, part of you is outside looking on. It may not be the dominant part yet, but a little bit of it is outside looking on. And as such, you're only half tangled. You're only partially tangled, and slowly, the whole system is getting a little bit more relaxed, and a little bit more impartial in that kind of looking, and I say that just by way of encouragement, and to say trust it, even if it feels like you know, you ever had that feeling like, well, I don't know, I think I'm here, you know, I kind of feel like I'm sort of half here, and. Maybe half not, but I'm half here, you know? That's good. That's good. So being caught up in self-view is really, no more than, repeatedly following the impulse to grab hold of sensation, feeling, and thought. That's why the Four Foundations of Mindfulness is so significant, a teaching. I think it's the most significant teaching in the whole Pali Canon. It's getting at that. It's saying, okay, with that as a reality, then try to relate to all of that differently. Try to stop getting caught up by seeing it phenomenologically, seeing it more objectively. And you know, being caught up in self-view is just reacting or relating to all of that that's happening out of some self-concern. You know, I was telling you earlier, you know, it's kind of like, I felt it one time, it's like having somebody who was always with me, who was always chattering, always creating problems and trying to come up with solutions to those problems. It's just like that, you know, like the commentator in a golf match who's always whispering alongside of you. Well, you know, you really shouldn't have done that, you know, or it should have been this way, that kind of thing. It's just going on and on and on and on like this. So as we work with the foundations of mindfulness, one of the things that we're doing is learning not to listen to the chatter, learning not to be preoccupied with that chattering of the mind. You know, the temptation for a while can be to do something to make that chattering stop. Well, you know, good luck. You know, it's not my experience particularly that it stops, because remember, with all of this, it's not the object that is the issue. It's the way we're relating to the object. So even the chattering doesn't have to stop under that definition. You know, it's all about what I was saying earlier about how you're attending. Are you paying attention to it wisely? Are you paying attention to it unwisely? That's where the action is. So we don't have to do anything to make it stop. We just have to see it happen and train ourselves to not to engage. And that's why I gave you that silly little exercise at lunchtime, you know, just to try. Can you have the actual experience of noticing that it's chattering away about everything that's going on in your activity, in your field of awareness, just noticing that it's chattering away, but then, you know, just not engaging it, not becoming the chattering, but just noticing that that's happening. So over time, we're actually operating more and more outside the purview of self-view. You know, it's interesting because you may not even see it happen. But I would say don't take my word for it. Look and see. And see for yourself. You know, there's a proof in your actual experience. Don't you find that even if you're still getting all caught up and still awash in delusion, many, many times throughout the day, that you are indeed getting free of old, tired, and worn out habits of mind and thought. Don't you find that that's true? And, you know, I pose that to you because I submit that if you don't think that's true, then you're not looking hard enough, you know, because it is definitely happening. And we have to notice that that is a key player in the process of waking up. You know, when we talk about the right efforts, it's overcoming the difficult stuff, but it's also cultivating the good stuff. And the only way, the way that you're going to do that, in the same way that you learn by observing the consequences of the difficult stuff, you observe this as well. And the mind gets a taste for it. It gets a taste for freedom, as Ajahn Chah put it. It likes the idea. It likes the experience of even just being a little bit awake. And it wants more of it. And that's a very skillful wanting. So we work with the foundations of mindfulness. We come to witness and observe this gradual erosion of self-view that's taking place because we're applying ourselves in the practice. And don't look for the aha moment. It's more subtle than that. It's just about not grabbing everything as much as we have in the past. And there's the skillful ways of relating when we come to what happens in those moments. And finally, the other thing that I brought up this weekend and want to reiterate is we're going to cultivate the capacity to be with things as they are through samadhi. It's a critical player in all of this. And it's important for us to put some attention on our understanding of it, and certainly on the cultivation of samadhi. You know, otherwise, you're just going to keep getting pulled in. We need a fair amount of stillness. You know, somebody asked Ajahn Chah once, how much do you need? And he said, you need enough for presence of mind. And so, I mean, let you chew on that a bit. What does that even mean? But he didn't say you've got to get into the jhanas and you got to do this and you got to do that. He said basically, you know, you need to chill. You need some stillness. And in fact, Buddha points to this right away at the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. You know, one of the first lines in the suttas where he's starting to give the instructions is he says this: we have to put away covetousness and grief for the world. And that's pointing to the greed and the hatred, the toing and froing, that incredible habit of the mind, now here, now there, the scattered perspective, the scattered habit of the mind, just constantly grabbing this and now that, this and that. And somehow one has to find a way to settle down out of that habit of mind. And what we call that settling out is stillness or samadhi. And most of us think of it as absorption maybe heretofore, but samadhi isn't the same kind of absorption as jhana. It's just a stillness. It's just a quieting in the mind. And one of the monasteries that I go to is called the Chitta Viveka, the quiet mind. And it's widely understood that this phrase is pointing to that. It's not an absorbed samadhi or absorbed jhana. It's actually just a quieting of the mind such that seeing is enhanced. The capacity for seeing is made, is enhanced. So it's just, ultimately, it's not only just about being able to quiet the mind when it's stirred, but it's actually getting to a place where it's not stirred in the first place. You know, it gets quiet enough that it's not a case of greeting recovery after having grabbed things with a quiet mind. It's actually not grabbing them in the first place. So it can get very mature. It can get very sophisticated. So, you know, you might find that 1,000 times a day one is spinning out and coming back. And as we practice, one of the things that we become aware of is how incredibly agitated the unawakened mind is, restless and agitated. You know, one of the hindrances for sure. But it's interesting to know that in the model, about the factors of, the stages of awakening, it's very clear that the Buddha is saying that restlessness is one of the last things to go. It's not uprooted until we're in the final stage of awakening. So, you know, I find that actually helpful contemplation. I mean, you could get depressed if you think about it the wrong way, but it's helpful to know that this anxiety that I feel is probably going to be around a while. You know, and in a way, it's a restlessness, right? It's restless. And so, the antidote to restlessness is kind of enduring it. Because, and if you just break that up, and enduring it means finding peace in the presence of it. So you can see how it's the antidote. One has to literally make peace with restlessness, and find that slowly but surely the mind, finds another path. It starts to kind of carve out different channels in the mind. It doesn't really need to go into all of that to deal with difficulty, but in the unawakened state, it does. One of the monks looks at, he defines samadhi in this way, and I think it's quite apt. He says, he relates it very much to the emotional nature of the human being and says that samadhi is an emotional maturity. It's a capacity to be still and at peace with things that, to have a feeling of being grounded and comfortable with things that even if they're difficult, especially if they're difficult. And I like that. So there's a lot to this practice, and one of the things that I came to see in my own practice a number of years ago is I was just contemplating non-attachment and how, as this grows, how the mind isn't grabbing. And as I said, what it's normally grabbing is things that are going on in the body and mind. And so this is, it's actually grabbing, it's like grabbing hold of things, that feel very personal and very intimate. You know, this is who I am. I am this body. I am this mind. And it's grabbing hold, of those and, kind of identifying, getting caught up, proliferating about it all. And yet there's this amazing paradox as non-attachment matures and develops. And that is that, what you're not attaching to is this stuff that feels very intimate and personal. You know, this is who I am. But that you're not grabbing that, right? And what you're left with is the simple, direct experience of what is. And so the paradox of non-attachment is as you become more unattached, you actually are entering the direct experience of and becoming infinitely more intimate and personal with what's actually happening in the body and mind, not how we're reacting to it all. And so it's amazing what he's pointing to here. Let go of preoccupation with it and you'll actually be with it. It's kind of nuts, but that's what he's saying. Let go of the reaction to a pain in the knee, and you'll know what a pain in the knee is. You know, let go of going on and on about with a particular state, and you'll know what the state is. It's kind of subtle stuff, you know, and you end up with this feeling that I'm here. And you know what here is, and it all becomes a lot more manageable. And so then now with that kind of non-attachment, we're well positioned for insight. And, you know, I've certainly touched on this weekend more than once. It's worth repeating that, the insights of insight meditation are many. There's many ways to characterize it, but the primary ones are seeing the impermanent suffering and selfless nature of all phenomenon of the body and the mind. Just know that very directly. And so I think the Buddhist teachings and practices just promise this in a way they kind of propose an interesting question. And it's as if it's saying, you know, what if all of our suffering, every bit of the suffering that we experience in this life is from not wanting to touch these? That's what it's presenting. And the practices then are being encouraging as our method to get us to what's real, to see what's actually happening here, to see the nature of this body and mind. And so they're very much directing us to touch these, you know, touch uncertainty, touch the changeability, touch the unsatisfactory nature of it all. Touch the experience of being out of control. And further, they're saying, inviting us to not only touch these, but touch our helplessness in relation to all of that. We are completely and utterly helpless. in the face of these realities. And in a way, to make peace with that. Yeah, you can feel the mind just go, you know, it just goes bonkers as an idea, you know. It's like, no, I want it all to be nice. I want it all to be clear. I want to know what's going to happen. I want to be on top of it. I want to do it right. I want to get it right. I want to be the master of my universe. Good luck. You know, it's not like that. And this is the heart, getting at the heart of the Buddha's teaching. You know, he says we just so don't want these realities to be true, but this is the way it is. And so we set, in not wanting it to be that way, we set up these defense mechanisms against it. And it's actually those defenses that we've set up that are our suffering. It's amazing, but that's what we're doing. That's our suffering is right there. So we were talking in the group to, you know, today, like, what do you got to lose? All your suffering. If we can just, see this and release it and learn, to relate differently, that the hindrances are trying to protect us from reality. They're trying to mask reality. And our task is to touch these realities and to keep touching them until the hindrances don't have a leg to stand on. There's no basis for them because we get it. We understand. And so they're not needed anymore. And with them goes self-view. Because they're the operating mode of self-view, largely. So all of this scrambling from the vantage point of self, I mean, I just see it as kind of a fool's attempt to, make reality not be reality, you know, make the way it is not be the way it is, you know, to protect us against these, realities. And yet we're vulnerable, and we always have been, and we always will be. And over time, you know, what I see the eradication of self-view affecting is that a comfort, a kind of a twisted kind of comfort and willingness with the vulnerability and willingness to be vulnerable. You know, one of the monks described it this way. He said he started to see himself and experience himself as kind of like a dish antenna. You know, and he had this image of himself just walking around the world, and his chest just kept getting bigger and bigger and more open. And, you know, and just kind of bring it on. I understand it now. You know, I can be with it. That kind of thing. It's really, really beautiful. And so, yeah, and he put it this way. He said, you know, over time, we come to realize that opening to our vulnerability is better than the sword, better than brandishing the sword, getting out all of our armor, you know, protecting ourselves, hiding away in a hovel in some way. You know, it's better, it's better than putting up all of the smoke screens. He said, just be in it. That's the way it is. And, it's just better to look at this, look these in the eye and just say yes. I accept life on its terms. This is the way it is, and I accept that. Can you feel that? You know, that's what we're doing in practice. And I mean, come on, you know, the Buddha goes for the jugular. I mean, he goes to the depths of delusion and gives us these amazing tools, amazing contemplations and reflections for breaking it up. So whether we know it or not, this is what our practice is all about. I'm in it, are you? Doesn't scare me a bit. Sounds very sensible and reasonable. So enough. I offer this for your reflection tonight. I hope it's helpful.